Today, we are tackling a challenge that many emerging software companies face: the high cost and scarcity of top-tier pre-sales talent. We all know that a great solution engineer can double your win rates, but for a smaller organization, hiring that six-figure FTE is a massive financial risk. So what if there was a different way? What if you could access enterprise-grade discovery and demos on a subscription basis? Joining me today is Jeremy Potoka, founder and CEO of Technology Leader Companies. Jeremy has pioneered the pre-sales as a service model, a fractional approach that allows resellers and startups to scale their technical sales capacity without the heavy upfront investment. In this episode, we dive into the mechanics of this model, the economic impact it has on partners, and in a fascinating twist, why Jeremy believes that former teachers like himself make some of the absolute best solution engineers in the business. It's a really insightful look at how we can rethink resourcing the technical sale. Let's jump into the conversation with Jeremy. So Jeremy, when you and I spoke first, for me, the concept of like pre-sales as a service, I mean, completely new, one of the reasons why we have this conversation, but maybe in your own words, what is pre-sales as a service? How would you describe it?
Yeah, the best way for me to describe that is really, if you look at how any SaaS solution is delivered, you know, on a subscription basis governed by some sort of resource tier structure, right? We take the same approach. We really have productized SE capability, SE bandwidth, and then we, on a fractional basis, provide that to lots of different software companies and software resellers.
So when you say fractional, you're saying that the team that works for you is not never 100% assigned to one of your accounts, but multiple?
Correct.
Potentially, or?
That's correct. Everyone has at least... let's just say two or three different solutions on average. That's kind of the breakdown. A lot of what we do has some significant overlap too within accounting software, supply chain software, manufacturing software. So the way we've organized ourselves is not by software product or platform. It's like, you're a construction tech expert, you're going to learn these two or three solutions. You're a manufacturing and supply chain expert, you're going to learn these two or three solutions.
Okay, so you're saying your team is organized sort of by like a verticality where they are an expert in a certain field and there is multiple software categories that are selling to this field. And then
correct,
this is the match that you're doing. All right.
Industry vertical is the best way to look at it.
All right. So, I mean, you founded the company, correct me, like 3-4 years ago?
Correct. Yep, it was a little over 4 years ago.
So what was your sort of initial pain point that triggered the idea that something like this could be successful in the market?
So I've worked in this channel of ERP software for almost 13 years now. It's called Acumatica. It's a Microsoft ERP accounting software product, sold mainly in North America. It is sold abroad, often under different kind of OEM or white label arrangements. So really the reason I thought this model might be successful was because, especially in a fragmented ecosystem, and if you think of any ecosystem, think of like Salesforce, ServiceNow, Oracle, Acumatica, like more Microsoft driven technologies where we are, it's oftentimes not just a single vendor that is selling the product. You have a platform that's built by the vendor, and then you have a distributed channel that is responsible for reselling, for implementing, right? The partner channel model in enterprise software is really a well-worn path for scalability. And that's why it's so common in our space. The downside of a fragmented channel is that you don't just have one company selling Acumatica. You have like 400 globally. And all of those 400 companies are small, right? They're, you know, even the biggest ones being 100 million in revenue, for us in the US especially, like that's still a relatively small business. It's not a big, big enterprise. I would say the average size of our clients in that space are 15 to 20 employees. You know, so when you're a firm that is reselling software, or you're a marketplace provider who has built an integration, a bolt-on, some other software that lives on top or connected to Acumatica, you might even be smaller. You might be 5 to 10 employees. So that's really the world that I knew before I started this business. It wasn't one big software company with a 100-person sales team and 30 SEs supporting the sellers. So that was the concept early on, was how can I build out almost as if it were one single company, right? How can I build out a team of 30 SEs and offer them to like the 700 companies that basically work inside of this single ecosystem? And that's what we've done.
Over 1,000 sales and pre-sales professionals at companies like SAP, Salesforce, and LeanIX are already benefiting from the Disco Deck. With the 60 most important questions covering decision-making, economic factors, technology, and 5 other categories, it takes your discovery to the next level. The Disco Deck is available in both German and English. Head over to discodeck.shop now to grab your copy. You'll find the direct link in the show notes, of course. Thanks for your support, and now back to the episode. All right, so let me get this right. Are you saying that your primary customer that you sell pre-sales as a service to are primarily partners of the big software companies? I mean, you mentioned Microsoft now a couple of times, which, I mean, maybe some background or context. If I'm looking at SAP, right? I mean, I know the German market a little bit. I've worked at SAP. SAP in Germany alone has like hundreds of partners that they work with. Exactly what you said, right? Teams of between 5 to 10 people, up to sometimes hundreds, in rare cases, thousands of employees. But the average SAP partner in Germany has definitely probably less than 100 employees. So smaller companies, they focus primarily on reselling and obviously implementation of SAP solutions. So this is sort of the space that we're talking about, if I'm just getting that right.
It's split like 50-50. 50% of it is a partner that's selling another product, right? Like we don't work with any SAP partners, but our main channel is equivalent to the SAP Business One channel. You know, it's like a mid-market solution implemented and sold by resellers. The other 50% of our business is companies that have an app that is integrated with SAP or integrated with Acumatica or integrated with Sage. And again, they're like usually only 5, 10, 15 employees, usually not in a position to float an SE. And even if they find one, they struggle to keep them for a long time because, you know, they want to grow out of that. They want to sell, you know, if the bolt-on solution is $15,000 a year, like they will eventually want to grow into selling a full ERP solution, right? More complex sales, more earning potential. So the attrition within all of these companies is really high for this role. So what's very common is you have a developer, a business owner of the partner entity, and they're the ones that are doing the demos. And as you know, you throw a consultant or someone that's not highly skilled at doing discovery and executing on a solutions role, typically doesn't go very well.
Look, I'm starting to understand now, because I definitely see what you mean. I've worked with many partners. I've never worked at a partner before, but I've worked with many throughout the course of my career. Mm-hmm. And the typical structure is, especially the smaller ones, they are founder-led sales. So they do the customer-facing activities before it comes to a contract. And then when the contract closes, the implementation team is then executing. And this is what you're describing, right? Those founders, they are probably, mm-hmm. I mean, they probably don't even have the time to focus on like demo excellence and all the sales strategies, because they are also leading a company. Yes, a small company, but they're still leading a company. So for them, it's almost like one of the many activities. Whereas when I understand you correctly, you provide a service where you say, hey, you can relax on the pre-sales activities. I have a dedicated team that you can leverage. Correct. They have already all the skills they require to do an excellent job. They only, I'm saying quote unquote, only have to learn the specifics of your solution and your offering, and then they're ready to go.
Yep, that's right.
And it's an interesting one, because when I have conversations with all of these partners, I often ask, do you have a dedicated pre-sales team? And some do, but most don't.
Mm-hmm. And even the ones that do, oftentimes they don't have enough capacity. So even some of our largest software reseller partners, they could just use some extra help. Maybe they have some really good manufacturing SEs, but they need some field service support. Like they don't have anyone that can learn to demo a field service module or a construction solution that's integrated with the overall ERP system. So that's really the gap that we feel. I think it's interesting what you said, Tim, about the concept of like the founder-led. What I see with founder-led, even in a reseller environment, and I should clarify too, these resellers aren't just taking the product and selling it. They're usually focusing on a specific vertical industry. Like you're not just selling a vanilla solution. A lot of times you've actually built your own IP as well. Like we're going to sell this ERP into the garage door manufacturing market, right? So like there's always something that they're adding on top. That's the whole reason the fragmented channel exists from the beginning is it's a platform play, right? The publisher's making the platform and all these reseller partners are going in and they're adding their own service and special IP to it. And that's what they're taking the market. You get what you find. We have a growing base of clients that are more startups that are not necessarily a partner, but you find the same issue, right? It's an owner, it's a founder. You get this founder-led or product-led sales experience, which is very different, as you know, from a highly skilled SE who's going to do a discovery or demo. It's less about what problems do I need to help you solve and then show that to you so that you'll make a buying decision for the solution. When a founder or product-led person is doing that, it's like, I'm going to show you everything in this product because, man, I made this. It's my baby. Like, you're going to love it. So it's that same problem we're solving for on both sides, the resellers and also the software makers themselves.
All right. So I just wanted to clarify that. So you also have clients that are not necessarily a partner, but the primary software manufacturer, and they would benefit from Correct. Additional pre-sales capacity. And so they come to you and say, hey, I have a need here.
Correct. Yeah.
What is preventing them from just creating that role by themselves? Why do they need you?
I mean, the SE talent pool is so thin, that person usually can't be found. If they've been faking it with a consultant or developer or owner doing demos as they come up, it's hard for them to, at the size companies we're working with, carve out, you know, $100,000, $200,000 for an SE. And it's like they're because the founder thinks they're already doing a good job and they don't, it's like adding an FTE. I find that folks, especially software developer focused, you know, software publishers themselves, they want to invest in more product, right? Especially in the early stage of a business. If we build it, they will come. That's their mantra. Let's just build more software. So let's hire more engineers. So there's a high value in these earlier founder kind of scale up stage, I would even call it, startups that they have no problem investing in more engineering and more product, but their go-to-market motion is not mature enough for them to really sit down and budget for a full-time SE.
It's an interesting one. I'm just thinking as you say this, I mean, engineers are not cheap FTEs either, right? I'm guessing developers are next to people who work in sales, probably on the highest earning side in the job market, at least in tech and yeah. in software.
Absolutely. Yeah, that is an interesting call out. But I again, if you look at the profile of a software company up to a certain revenue number, it's really a focus on building.
Yes.
I was in Lisbon last week for Web Summit. There were 70,000 people there. I talked to lots of early stage startups and some scale ups. And they're not even really focused on demoing to get the product in end clients' hands yet. They're focused on demoing to raise funds, right? So if the way you see the world at that point in your company life cycle is a focus on product, right? You know you need a salesperson and you can kind of fake it with a salesperson and an engineer or a consultant or an owner, right? And it's like that it works for a lot of people, but that's where if we can take the dollars off the table and say, it's not going to be $200,000 a year. It's going to be, you know, $3,000 a month. and you get that as you get the same experience because we're white labeling our service as well. We're literally setting that on my SE up with an email address. So it's a fully white labeled, I mean, it's their end clients don't know that they're a fractional resource, right? So, and usually when they start to see, oh, this person does the job differently than we did, right? Oh, they're actually making us do discovery before we do a demo, right? Like all these things that those of us that have been doing the solutions SE, solution consulting role for a long time, it's like, this is just normal, right? And kind of what we expect. But for them, they're not, the maturity for go-to-market is not there. They don't see it
and
that way.
I'm starting to understand now. I mean, basically you are saying, hey, before you potentially risking spending 100 to 200K on an FTE, you're saying, hey, let's approach it step by step. Let's think about a part-time resource, which will only cost you, you said something along the lines of like $3,000 per month, and you can sort of try it out and you can see the impact. And if by then you see the capacity to actually occupy a person full-time, you can still then on a second stage, I guess, move over and then open up the full FTE. But this is sort of like a risk-averse way with lesser money amount, but still getting the benefit from it.
It's you know, 36,000 is a lot better than 150,000.
No, absolutely.
And that's where, especially Harvard Business Review, right around the same time I started my business 4.5 years ago, they published a study on the impact of SEs in sales and in go-to-market. And It was the timing of it was so cool. I certainly hadn't talked to them about it or anything. It was like I launched my business a month later, this thing came out. And the summary of this article and study was three things. If you invest in pre-sales, you will see faster sales cycles. You will see better closed won ratios, and you will see higher deal values. So the sales are going to take less time to close. They're going to be for more money and it's going to happen faster. And at a higher clip, right? Better win percentage. So, you know, when we walk into, especially in an ecosystem that's selling the same platform product, like an SAP or like an Acumatica in our example, and we ask them what their win rates are, and then we show them our win rates and data, and it's double. You know, and then you also introduce the cost arbitrage of having a fractional resource that 6 months from now, if your pipeline totally dries up, you just stop the subscription, right? Don't renew our subscription. And that's why it's just grown like wildfire in the world that we're living in within Acumatica specifically, because it does work. Like it works well. And, the interesting thing for me has been, I thought we'd be a stopgap solution for people, right? It was like, we come in, instead of them hiring one person, we give them three just because people take vacations and we want to make sure we have good availability. And I thought, all right, a year in, 2 years in, they're going to outgrow us. They're going to want their own SE. It's only happened twice. Two times that's happened. Because the model works, right? They really build a relationship with an SE. The sellers like working with our SEs. Once they start to see success and greater success than they have had in the past, it's like, this is working. Why should we stop, right? That's my best renewal conversation with the client. It's like, I know we keep saying we're going to hire our own SE, but like we got all these other fires to put out in our business. Like, this is working. Let's just keep doing it.
So you're saying the tenure that a partial SE placement is typical, it extends most of the time. You don't, I mean, I guess there's initial contract period, I don't know, 3-6 months or whatever, but they're extending because they say, hey, this is working for us, we're happy with it.
Nice. That's right. Yep, it's a 6 month. We'll do a 3 month trial as long as the learning curve for the solution isn't great, because we're investing a lot on the front end, right? We're going to basically be onboarding these folks like an employee. And then if it's a new software solution, then we also have to learn the sales cycle for that. We need to learn the tool. We need to, You know, if we already have the SE skills down, demo, discovery, presentation, storytelling, all those important elements. Now it's just learning the solution and how it fits into their context.
Have you discovered sort of like a let's say onboarding hack? I understand they bring the soft skills, but like there are really complex software solutions out there. I know of some cases, a friend of mine told me recently, hey, I joined this company now. I have a 6-month onboarding plan and basically 80% of that is product. Like this wouldn't work in your case, I'm guessing, but like how do you do it?
I'll just go back to the SAP example because it's a common thing. A lot of the folks listening to this will understand. Like we operate in a specific family of technologies, and I know how to scale that really well. So if your average SAP reseller said, hey, could you do pre-sales for us? I'd really have to think hard on that. Because what that means for me is now I'm moving into a whole new ecosystem. There's some overlap with our current client base and partner base. But now the only reason I would do something like go that far out of the world we know is because there's like, I get three at one time, right? Or there's some sponsorship from the software publisher. And we've had a lot of great conversations with other publishers to do exactly that. They're like, hey, we want you to be in our channel. So we'll fund this. And then we'll introduce you to a dozen partners, right? The onboarding still for an SE in particular, for a lot of this, you know, our average deal size is 65,000-70,000 mm-hmm. US dollars per year and another 100,000-200,000 in services. Like it is, you know, transactional sales don't require a competent SE. I mean, people might disagree with me on that, but if I'm demoing a solution that's $50 a month or $150 a month, like a lot of times the seller is also the one doing the discovery and the demo on a transactional sale. So that wouldn't be a fit for us. So we do kind of require the certain level of complexity because that's where the holes are. And, you know, our onboarding time for new SEs for Acumatica is 9 months. I mean, it takes 9 months.
So you're basically also disqualifying certain companies because you wouldn't want to go into the complexity that they bring and you would only consider it if it's investment, not only for this one company, but maybe for a whole ecosystem where you then expand your own horizon as part of the services that you provide. Okay, understood.
That's right. It's for us, our ideal customer profile is B2B SaaS companies. B2C is not usually a good fit. So it is business to business. And it's usually like anything, ERP is so vast, we kind of had a benefit of starting there because anything that's related to inventory software, accounting software, financial software, warehouse management software, you know, like it's a really wide array. So outside of Acumatica, we also demo 50 of the solutions that do things like e-commerce, sales tax calculation. All of this is largely related to like this kind of blanket of business to business SaaS solutions, right? If someone came to me and said, we built an AI automation tool for cybersecurity, right? I'd have to think really hard about taking that client because it's outside of our wheelhouse. You know, from a scalability standpoint, in the future, might we spin up a cybersecurity SE practice? If the demand was there, sure. But again, I'd need to really understand the demand because we could do it. You know, it's just time and people. We have the processes in place, right? It's more of is the market demand there for us to do something like that?
Before I forget, you just mentioned a minute ago that HBR journal that talks about SE and the influence of SEs to company success. Maybe after this conversation, you can share the link. I'll put it in the show notes for listeners to read up on it. I certainly want to read up on it. I don't think I have read it. Sounds certainly quite interesting. Yep. And one of the points you made in there, which leads me to my next question is, what is the economical impact of SEs? So I'm guessing, I mean, when I look at software sales, what we typically would do is we do an ROI calculation, right? You invest 100,000 euros in our solution, but we're solving a problem that is maybe 500,000, 1 million a year worth. So yeah, so you have a 10x return on your investment. Do you do something with your customers as well?
You know, when I started the business, I had an ROI calculator and it compared, you know, things like lost sales because your win rate is a bit lower than the benchmark it should be at. Or, you know, if your other option you're considering is hiring a full-time SE, that's going to cost you, you know, X, Y, and Z. Base, variable, benefits, Social Security, fully loaded, right? All the things. And to be honest, the value for most of our clients, like, we didn't even have to go there because they've tried, right? They've tried to hire SEs, a lot of them. And so the ROI is really apparent. It is a really interesting, so short answer, we don't dive into that just because the ROI is typically apparent to the folks we're working with. We don't need to do a large study on it. But you could look at it so many different ways. I mean, we take it from a cost perspective. Here's your other option for a W-2, you know, full-time employee. The real way to look at it would say, let's assume your win rate is 20% right now. And next year, you don't get any more leads than you got this year. You get the same amount of leads, but we actually convert at a 35% rate, right? Without investing in any marketing, any additional lead gen, all we're doing is actually converting your pipeline. And what's amazing in SaaS, as you know, Tim, is we can literally take not just year one revenue. We can say, if that means that your company, that 15% makes up $500,000. That's not $500,000. That's like, really, it's like, you know, $5 million, because we're going to 10x that over the customer lifetime value. So, I mean, you know, you could look at it so many different ways. And we're certainly charging a whole lot less than $500,000 or $5 million, right? We might be charging for someone like that. We might cost $120,000, but like if you told me spend 120 to make 500 this year and you know 380 net, but over the lifetime value of these customers closer to $5 million, like why wouldn't you do it?
100%. So how do you? I mean, now I'm so obviously curious. How many SEs do you currently have working for you?
We have about 20 today. Yep. Mm-hmm. We have 20. We have 30 employees in total, but we have branched out into a couple. As we started helping people with pre-sales, they said, hey, could you help us with marketing? So I also created a marketing agency that helps with top of funnel. And then as we help people start closing deals, they were like, we need help implementing. Can you guys help? My experience as an SE prior to starting this company, I worked for a great reseller of Acumatica. Wonderful company to work for. The number one issue in mid-market software as an SE, from my perspective, is that you're such an attractive role because you communicate well, you know the product well, people like you, you know, you're usually driven, like you're basically a salesperson on a commission basis, right? So you're driven. So what I have seen happen to a lot of SEs, and this was my experience, even at a wonderful company, was that you get pulled and marketing says, hey, we're doing an event in San Diego. Can you do a 15-minute, we have a speaking engagement. Can you go do that, right? Because you're the presentation guy. Or as you win deals, people are like, hey, we're going to do a year project. Can we get just like a little bit of Jeremy in the implementation, right? Because we want to make sure it starts well. So what was real, and that's how you get to burnout. That's how you burn out as an SE. There's literally no amount of money you can pay someone to work 70 hours a week, right? So what was really important to me when I was setting this company up is our bread and butter and what we focus on is pre-sales. But in order to also continue servicing those clients well, when they ask us and step out either up to marketing or down to delivery, I wanted to be able to help them, just not with my SEs. Yes.
I love that.
You know what I mean? It was like, we're going to bring on actual marketing people that will execute better than an SE because this is what they focus on. They don't do demos. And then on the other side, we're going to bring on, have our own delivery team because I want to help you deliver, project manage, but I'm not going to ask my SEs to do it. So, you know, it's also like one of the challenge for us, right, is we could train somebody and then they could just go work for one of our clients, right? That has not happened yet. And I think the reason it's happened is because we really try to value the work-life balance. and stay in this lane. It's like, this is what you're doing. You're not, you don't need to speak at an event. You don't need to write a blog. We've all been asked, right, to write a blog for something, for marketing, right? So it's like, here's your lane. And I want you to just have like this job is amazing. Being an SE is the best job in the world. And I want you to actually just be paid right. well to do that and not have to do these other things. No, sorry, I went off on a big tangent there, but I'm very passionate about it.
I love it. And this brings me to one question that was asked by actually one of the leaders in our community, Tobias. He was saying, hey, what is the scope sort of the service? I mean, you mentioned demo a lot. You also mentioned discovery, but you also explicitly said, hey, the marketing conference and the engineering implementation is out of scope. What about like RFPs or...
Correct.
I don't know, maybe like development for custom projects and stuff like that. How far does the scope of the roles go that you provide?
Yeah, it really does everything except, marketing and delivery excluded, yeah. right? Because, and again, we help with that. It's just we have different branches of our company that do that. That's the other 10 people that are not in the 20 SEs that we have. We'll do the RFPs.
How about like pilots, POCs? Yep.
So if they need
like
help
that.
With RFPs, yep, we'll do proof of concept. We might bring in someone from our consulting team if it really gets down into a heavy level of detail. I'm not a big fan. You know, POC is, everybody defines POC a little differently. If it's a 3 to 5 day POC effort, sure, our SE can support that. If we're talking about a 3 month engagement for, you know, $50,000 POC, we're going to pitch that over to the fence because we have solution consultants that are more delivery focused and not sales focused, and it's a better fit over there.
All right. And how do you find the right talent for your team? I mean, I guess those individuals they are probably a bit different than maybe the average SE because they require more flexibility. But like maybe you can walk me through that a little bit.
Yeah.
How you identify talent for your teams.
So I'll give you a little background on me first. I did not go to like business school or engineering, computer school, anything like that. I was a teacher. I actually was a adjunct professor in Spanish. So I spent time abroad, loved linguistics, you know, at very like much had that academic track. I also taught 8th grade Spanish for 5 years. That was like, and I tell people that experience was better than going like the software business route because dealing with 158th grade students and their parents sometimes has really prepared me to be a very good SE. Like a lot of our business is in person still. So I'll be on site at a manufacturer doing a demo. And the questions are just coming at me and some of them are good. Some of them are insulting. A lot of personalities in the room. That doesn't rattle me at all, right? I was trained by 30 eighth graders at a time, and trying to teach them a different language, right? ERP is actually very easy. Doing that with students is very challenging. So, but if you think about it, what do you learn as a teacher, right? You're learning to communicate. You're learning to summarize these ideas. You're trying to get the other students in the classroom to take some sort of action. So we have several former teachers. I actually hired one last year. He's a former Spanish teacher. So it's been a wonderful route for us to hire former teachers because their expectation for what they're going to make isn't like they're starting at a high SE rate. So I have the ability in our budget to be able to hire someone that may not actually demo Acumatica or another solution for 9 months, right? Because I have the time to invest in them. We have a whole mentorship and onboarding and training structure. And the person that built and runs a lot of that was also a teacher. So, you know, that model for us has worked really well. And we get the feedback all the time about why is your, like, we had 3 vendors do demos. Why was yours different? And it's like, well, we're used to working with kids and explaining things at an 8th grade level. And it really does make a huge difference. So that's my profile. I'm in our ecosystem, there's not that many SEs. And what happens sometimes is they hire from like one partner to another, or they hire from one one like sales tax automation company right. to another sales tax automation company. I've been in this Acumatica world for a long time. I have had certain people that even worked for me before follow me here. But outside of that, our normal person we hire never did the SE job before. But they were pastor or public speaker of some sort, teacher, like that's the profile that I can really do something with fast.
It's I'm fascinated, especially since you just said pastor. Yeah? I certainly did not expect that one. But I mean, that sounds super interesting. So, I mean, this is probably a whole conversation on its own. So, I'm curious, maybe you can give me a brief on it. Like, how do you teach these people all the SE skills? Like, how do you teach them the discovery, the demo? You said you have an own onboarding in your company. So I'm guessing that's sort of part of it. But like in a nutshell, yeah. Like what's your process?
So I would say just kind of one blanket statement before a lot of our, it's basically a requirement that these folks that haven't done the SE job before work out of our office. We're about an hour west of Philadelphia in a town called okay. Lancaster, Pennsylvania, a small city here. So we have invested in physical office space, and a lot of those junior folks that have not done this job before, they are sourced out of Lancaster County. So they're here. It's easier yeah. to be a sponge and learn to do anything new when you're actually in person, or I'm doing a demo from my, conference room table over here, and they're just sitting there taking notes, and I give them things to do either in the demo or part of the discovery. Just here, you're going to ask questions around this one thing, and I'm going to prep you for that one thing, and then we're going to jump in. So that in-person component really has been I hired someone that was a teacher three and a half years ago, and he sold $4 million of software right. last year.
Oh.
Right. And he would not, he even says, I wouldn't have been able to do that if I was a remote employee. Like I wouldn't have gotten the reps in. I wouldn't yeah. have been a good sponge. Outside of that, what we have, again, it's the teacher in us. We have a rubric, and the rubric basically says, hey, this SE job is pretty complex. You need product knowledge. You need sales acumen. You need the pre-sales skills. And I even break out for me, what's always really important is presentation skills. Because I think like for some reason in society, we've lost the art of like teaching people how to public speak, right? And watch their own recordings and even just pulling out the verbal crutches that they use that are distracting to people. So I might be a little excessive on that, but again, if a client is hiring us to do awesome discoveries that are engaging and do knockout presentations, we have to be actually serve them better than if we were a W-2 employee, because they could just end the contract and not renew, right? So we have a whole structure around this. We have five domains of doing the pre-sales job. A lot of it's like, there are some great books out there that we've all learned over the years, like Demo to Win. That's not that we integrate into what we're already doing. So we have them read like a sales book. We have them read. One of my favorite things that we've done, if you know who Anthony Iorino is, The Lost Art of Closing.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a book for sellers. But it's one of the things teachers or former pastors, like that the sales environment's new, right? So I need to give them artificial experience with that. And so that these have been ways that we do it. So, in a nutshell, that's just a summary of, I don't like the word onboarding because it feels like onboarding is something HR does. But it's more of like, hey, we're going to invest in you. We're going to make sure you have a good experience. You're going to be a good sponge. And then we're also going to take you through a process that we have built to create SEs.
All right. Now, there was one other question that came around. Actually, what does it cost me? Right. And you gave some initial insight on it. You talked about like $3,000 per month, for example. But I could also imagine, and this is where my question is going, that you probably have people who are maybe placed as like junior SEs and then maybe like more senior, and maybe there's a bandwidth or something there. Like, can you give us those ranges? Like, what is a typical range
for the service for pre-sales? So the beautiful thing about this, so the range, we have clients that are say like $2,500 to $3,000 a month up to $20,000 a month. at the 20,000 mark, we're really like their full-time pre-sales team, okay? The other thing that's very important for me is we do bill for a commission just year one revenue, right? So we're going to bill 5% of commission on year one revenue. That's how our model works. So that way I can pass commission back to
the
SBs,
so right? Yeah,
they're
okay.
All compensated on a variable basis. Yeah. So, you know, a client that's paying us $20,000 a month may actually pay us like $300,000 in a year, right? But someone who's paying us $3,000 a month may pay us $50,000. Like, but again, we're doing that because we're helping them close a lot of business. So that's the model. The beautiful thing about having a fixed fee subscription service like this, and it's all driven by the amount of time that we spend working their deals. And we have a kind of a cool factor to build that out in a fair way, where like if we're, you know, working on an RFP or we're doing prep for a demo, you know, the subscription's built around the milestones they understand, like demo and discovery. Okay. So from there, you ask the question on resources, right? As long as we're delivering, I'll have one senior resource on. I'll have two kind of not junior, but maybe not the most senior resource on that can help each other if they get backed into a corner. I'll have a senior and a junior. Maybe the junior does the overview part of the demo and the senior. The client doesn't care. They want us to help them win the deal, right? So it allows me the flexibility. It's the same rate if I have one SE or two SEs on a demo. So we really don't have to have a tiered structure because of the fixed fee.
And you already partly answered the question I was having on my mind the entire time. How you incentivize? So, but if I understood you correctly, you're saying, hey, whenever together with the team that you're providing to your customers, you're closing deals, you put an extra charge, in your case, you said 5% of the deal value, and you then distribute that across, I guess, your own team and part of also obviously your own profit model, I'm guessing.
Correct.
So your SEs also earn commissions, in other words.
Absolutely. Nice. Absolutely. You know, if we're going to, sometimes when I talk to people that are SEs that aren't, don't have any variable component, I'm like, you know, what gets you up in the morning? I don't understand that. Like, you know, for me, that was always the upside. It was like, I've never worked for a company that capped that. So I was like, I want to help you close as many deals as possible. Right. And that's our structure as well. Like we're, you know, our SEs all have a base and they have a variable comp component to it. And when they all have a target too, we look at that basically at the year and say, you're working with this group of clients or this one. Here's kind of, I also have executive meetings with the clients or someone else from my team does. So we kind of know, hey, what are you guys looking to do in 2026? What I love about this whole model is that our clients forget we're at an outside resource. I mean, we get invited to their sales kickoffs. And like, you know, they'll fly us to their sales kickoff and we're not necessarily presenting. We're just there with their sellers learning and talking about what the next year looks like. And we're deep, you know, we're deep into these organizations. It's not just, I equate it to like, sometimes people think we're a demo vending machine. It's like, I just give you the transcript from the discovery and you do a demo. That's not for us. Like we are a holistic kind of true form pre-sales engineering, solutions engineering model. And if you're not going to help us qualify in and out deals, if you're not going to involve us in discovery, we're not going to be able to put together a good demo. Now, because we do all that work, we also earn the incentive when we help you close business.
All right. So last question that I have on my mind, and then I would probably check the community chat again if there was maybe one or two more questions added in the meantime. But the one that I have, like if you think about your own company now, I mean, you said you founded the company 4 years ago. You have now 20 SEs in the team that you're positioning in different clients. You have a focus on a certain, let's say, industry and also category. You mentioned Automatica and ERP. Like, where do you see this heading? Like, are you planning to branch out to other software categories and to other industries? Are you staying it like that because it works for you? I'm just curious. Like, also, I mean, I'm guessing you're focusing on the US. Obviously, I'm Germany based. I'm sure in Europe there could be a demand for such services as well.
Yeah, that's part of what I was in Lisbon for last week, you know, is really vetting what kind of, we have a couple of clients in Europe and have had others that are no longer active. One in particular. And you know, 85, 90% of our business is in North America. So the theory that we're testing is, especially for like the easiest thing for us to do is help a European software company, or we have one client in Australia and New Zealand. That's a Europe is easy compared to Australia, right? Because that time zone difference is just wild. Sure. for those guys. So we're basically the like one of their North American SEs because they're starting to build a team out here, but we also have experience and exposure and we've been working with them for a long time. Same thing with our European clients, right? If they have they built an app, it integrates with some of these other solutions we're already working with. And their largest market is actually in North America. But now you're talking about establishing a whole North American presence, a seller, an SE, a delivery team, right? There are a lot of obstacles to that. So we partnered with a couple of companies that actually will do sales as a service or the SE. You know, so we can really augment, basically be the kind of beginnings of someone's North American go-to-market strategy. So that is definitely part of our growth strategy moving forward, something that we're looking forward to continuing to do. Outside of that, you know, I'm always just open to what other ecosystems. For I keep using that word, but it's important to me, right? Because if there's an ecosystem of not just one company selling the same software, but 100 or 50, we're going to have the same problems our current client base experiences in a fragmented channel. They don't have the resources. The benefit is that kind of smaller niche boutique consulting experience that the end client gets when they buy the software. They're not working with a 1,000-person company. They're working with like a local reseller that focuses on garage doors or whatever it is, you know? But so that challenge exists in other ecosystems. And that's probably where we're headed is, what other ecosystems could benefit from this model where I can scale very fast? And even if it didn't work out for one client in the ecosystem, it'll work out for five others.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And I mean, I brought the SAP example in the beginning of our conversation, right? I'm also thinking about, you mentioned Microsoft. I'm thinking about Oracle. I'm thinking about Amazon. I'm thinking about ServiceNow. Because they all have started to build like a really large ecosystem in Germany, but also, of course, in Europe. So with literally hundreds, sometimes thousands of companies, mid-sized companies that are reselling, which probably have many of the challenges that we spoke about earlier in this conversation.
Even someone like Salesforce, right? Like Salesforce has all these resellers. You can obviously buy it. That's the difference, right? Acumatica, you can't buy from Acumatica. You have to buy from a reseller. Kind of, and I know depending on the model of SAP, it works largely the same way. But for Salesforce, even if you buy it through the Salesforce, you implement with a local partner. And then there's the marketplace. Now you have all these marketplace solutions, right, that really help you use Salesforce. So even folks in the marketplace like that, they built their own software. They're a 15-person company and they're selling, you know, 20 deals a year. They'd love to have someone else do the demos. Like it's those types of fragmented spaces that I see us heading into.
Jeremy, this has been a very insightful conversation. I learned a lot. Fascinating model. I mean, clearly it works quite well. 4 years ago, you founded the company. You're still there and have fantastic, to me, compelling growth plans. So maybe in a year or two, we can do a check-in again because I'm certainly curious how it went. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for sharing your story. Thanks for sharing what pre-sales as a service is.
Well, I appreciate the conversation and insight. You know, pre-sales and solutions engineering is like such a small world.
Cool. Thank you so much, Jeremy. This was Pre-Sales Unleashed, your podcast for sales engineering in B2B software sales. If you enjoyed this episode and were able to take away some valuable insights, please subscribe to the show. If you have questions, feedback, or topic requests, write to us. We look forward to every message on LinkedIn and we'll typically answer everything. You can find links to our profiles in the show notes. Thank you for joining us and see you next time.